Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we have so much to talk about. Varsha and I were just having a discussion before we started recording about, you know, we try to like piece the stories together and make it a good flow of conversation. And we were just like, nope, these don't relate at all. And there's tons to talk about. So we're just going to jump right in. So we're going to be talking about a range of topics. Yeah, there's a lot going on. It feels like it never ends, and that's because it doesn't. And every day is a fresh hell, seriously.
Yeah, I seriously cannot wait until January whatever, 2021, where I can just take a deep breath, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So before we get started, Varsha, what is new with you?
What's new with me? I haven't really done anything new, just really enjoying teaching for the second semester. My students are really cool. I also, without endorsing or unendorsing Howard Schultz, I asked my students a really cool question. I asked them, what can, if you had to give Howard Schultz a textbook on U.S. history, what chapter would you ask him to read first? And multiple students got the answer correct, which is have him read about Theodore Roosevelt and the 1912 election, when Theodore Roosevelt formed his own third party and ran against the Democrat and the Republican, ended up splitting the vote with the other Republican, and Woodrow Wilson won the presidency. Just a little history for you. Howard Schultz is no Theodore Roosevelt, so there's no way he's going to come close to that. But it's important to know that history is a lesson as well as, you know, a book.
All right, Varsha, so the first thing we're going to talk about is an attack. So an attack on an actor named Jussie Smollett. So can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah. So Smollett, he stars in the TV show Empire, which is a great TV show. And he's walking down the street in Chicago, and he is basically attacked when two unknown people approached him, got his attention, and started yelling out racial and homophobic slurs. And then they began to beat him with their hands, and also poured an unknown chemical substance on him. So basically the police at this point couldn't confirm the gender of the offenders or identify the chemical substance. But at some point, these assaulters wrapped a rope around Jussie Smollett's neck. A rope, basically a noose, right? So this is a modern day lynching. That's attempted lynching. That's basically what happened here. And it's also clear that when we talk about intersectionality, this is what we're talking about. There are, you know, Jussie Smollett was not only African-American, he was also gay. And so it's important to recognize the fact that these assaulters knew that they could attack him on both fronts. And they did so. They did so. This was a homophobic and a racist beating. This was a modern day attempted lynching in the sense that it was racist, but it was also a homophobic attack. And it's so heartening to see that there are people who are tweeting and talking about this that could understand that. And then there are also people who obviously didn't understand that. But what was really frustrating was literally, I would say, like half of these news outlets tweeted out racially charged, but also tweeted out homophobic.
Right.
And I was like, how much, like, there was a great joke on Twitter, and I'm so sorry I cannot credit her because I can't find the tweet, but somebody said, how much charge does it have to be for something to be racist? Is racially charged like a battery? Is racism a battery? Like, where is the level of battery charge that we need to call it racist and not just racially charged? How long does it have to be charging, you know? And I think that was – it's a great joke, and it's also really, really incisive in the sense that, like, there's this idea in anytime you write the words racially charged that there is a threshold where something becomes racist. And if an attempted lynching in 2019 is not racist, I don't know what is. If calling him racist slurs isn't racist, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, I've also – what I also wanted to talk about, what Varsha, you hit on it exactly, is that the reporting around this has been astonishingly shitty. You know, they keep saying it's, racially charged or allegedly a homophobic attack or, and I, you know, I read one piece on Washington Post, the way it was written, it made it sound very much, there are police officers who don't believe that this actually took place. Yeah, there was a quote, Detectives who are investigating the allegations as a possible hate crime have looked at hundreds of hours of surveillance video from businesses and hotels in the heavily monitored area. Chicago has one of the most comprehensive surveillance systems in the United States. But he said they still needed to collect and view more. And goes on, the lead detective said, "We haven't seen anybody at this point matching the description he gave. Nobody looks menacing, and we didn't find a container anywhere," referring to a container for the liquid that the actor said was thrown on him. So it just very much makes it seem like they're questioning his story. Did you get that from, like, that quote?
I did feel that. And I also felt that right as the initial statements were coming out. Because initially, the statement said that Jussie Smollett said somebody yelled at him, the assaulters yelled at him, "This is MAGA country," right? And initially,
right,
the police released a statement, CPD released a statement saying, "We don't know if that is true." And I understand that they are doing police work, and they probably hate it when the public is speculating on who did a crime or how a crime was committed or whatever before they get to finish their investigation. We talk about this when we talk about, you know, FBI investigations all the time. But there's a difference between that. There's a difference between the public interfering in what is an investigation or the public wanting the truth on exactly what they see, right? And there's a difference between that. And you have to offer assurances that you are treating this as the hate crime that it is. And I feel like literally I feel like being both sides about it at that moment was really, really indicative of the fact that we live in a country that is conditioned towards white supremacy. And again, I don't know the races of these the ethnicities of these investigators, the genders of these investigators, their sexual orientation. I'm not accusing them individually of something. I'm accusing the institution of police in this country, not just in Chicago, is geared against believing people of color and women and queer people of color.
Yeah, that's what
it's geared
just
against.
Say,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, the Washington Post report also had a recent citation for a recent FBI report. There was a 17% increase in hate crimes in 2017, the third consecutive year such crimes increased. So they've been increasing since 2015. I wonder what happened in 2015. In 2017, there were 7,175 hate crimes reported by federal law enforcement agencies. Nearly a third targeted Black Americans, and 16% were aimed at people based on their sexual orientation. And so it's so clear that this is a hate crime, but also it's so clear that there is an emboldening happening for bigots in this country since 2015. I'm not putting all of that onus on Donald Trump, because that would be irresponsible of me. I'm putting it on this idea that he has been able to propagate since his first day on the campaign, since Charlottesville, whatever, that it is okay to both sides certain issues. And this is something that it's not just him. The whole Republican Party has been doing it for years, but it has intensified since 2015. And it has intensified since Obama got elected in 2008. Right. And so, again, it's not just on one person, because that's, again, not how historians write history. That's not how people understand politics. It's not how causation works. But it's more that it's so clear when you're looking at these statistics, when you're looking at children reported, Mexican children and Hispanic children being reported that they're being bullied in school with, like, wall imagery. Right. It's clear that there is a culture shift going on where it's easier and easier to be a bigot. To be a bigot and receive no shame whatsoever.
Right. Well, and yeah, I mean, I guess in this reporting, it felt very much like the hate crime equivalent of asking Smollett, "What were you wearing?" Right?
Yeah.
Like when with like rape cases where, the first questions are not about how do we catch the perpetrators, but what was your part in your own attack?
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of dismissal that, we haven't been able to find video of this. And so it just, you're right. I think it's all about this culture shift that's been happening, that it's not necessarily Trump, but it is, we're steeping in racist tea, this entire country.
Yeah.
And I feel like this reporting ignores that. Most reporting ignores that. And this is just a sort of lightning bolt case where it all kind of comes together with this modern day attempted lynching and this questioning of the veracity of the claims because of who the target was.
Yeah, it's just horrific. I mean, there was another another aspect to this is something that Black gay men, as well as Black people on Twitter, as well as queer people on Twitter were bringing up, is that it's never funny to make homophobic jokes. You know, the jokes of like beating your gay son or would you accept your gay son or whatever, like homophobic jokes like that are never acceptable because they lead to this type of hate, right? This small instance of a joke leads to greater and greater hate when it's not checked. And then eventually you get to a position where someone is being attacked for their sexuality and also for their race. And so that's why, like, it's so, my heart goes out to him and to what he is going through right now, because it is so difficult to be a Black person in this country as well as someone who is gay, because you are dealing with two levels of bigotry against you, right? And it is hard to even exist. And I feel like that was like the underlying layer of the discussion online, which I found really helpful, is to make sure that you are checking your language anytime you're talking about homosexuality, about the LGBTQ community, is that you're making sure that you are listening to them. And I think that's what initially it felt like CPD, this Chicago Police Department, wasn't doing. And it also felt like the reporting, at least headline writers, were not listening to the whole country when they're saying, yeah, this was fucking racist, man. And I was homophobic. Like, we can call it a spade. We can call a spade a spade.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is really just does point to the importance of intersectionality at all times, but particularly when we're dealing with this white supremacy forward administration. And right. So I also, Varsha, wanted to touch on this kind of roiling debate about late term abortions. So New York codified their abortion laws, and that set everyone's hair on fire, apparently, because that's all anyone was talking about on the internet. And then Ralph Northam, who's the governor of Virginia, presented his own bill for Virginia to codify their abortion laws and has made some sort of confusing comments. And it's made the whole conversation about late-term abortion. So can you take us through what is in that bill?
Yeah, so Virginia House Bill 2491 basically rolls back a bunch of requirements, restrictions on abortion, including the 24-hour waiting period and this mandate that second trimester abortions take place in a hospital, basically something that could only have been done because Democrats are now elected, have more power in Virginia in the legislature, right? But the controversy, as you mentioned, is all about this third trimester abortions. And so basically under current Virginia law, in order for a patient to terminate a pregnancy in the third trimester, three doctors have to certify that continuing the pregnancy would likely cause the patient's death or substantially and, quote, irredeemably impair her mental or physical health. So it requires three doctors to certify that you definitely cannot take this pregnancy to term, right? And so the new bill reduces the number of doctors to one and removes the terms substantially and irredeemably. It removes the substantially and irredeemably qualifier. And so basically abortions would be allowed in cases where a mother's mental or physical health is threatened, even if the damage might not be irreversible, right? Which makes sense because it's prioritizing the woman's health. Because pregnancy is a woman's health issue. It's also an issue for like non-binary people, but like it's a healthcare issue. It's not an issue that you should be like pouncing on, right?
I really just want to like put a finer point on that. This is a healthcare issue that intersects with women's and non-binary people's care issues.
Yeah.
And I think people tend to forget that. This is not an ideological debate as much as the anti-choicers would like you to believe.
Exactly. And then so all the controversy began when an anti-choice House delegate in Virginia, Virginia delegate Kathy Tran, said in a committee hearing that it would technically allow abortion until the point of birth if a doctor agreed it was necessary. What the fuck? No. You can't abort a baby after it has been born. You cannot abort a baby. You cannot abort a fetus right when it's being born. That's not how it works. You can only abort a fetus if it is, one, non-viable, which doctors disagree on the date of viability, which, again, is between a person and their doctor, or if it is hurting the mother's health or the baby's health, right? There are so many, many reasons a woman decides to have an abortion, but late-term abortion is not a medical term. It is a term created by anti-choicers to basically vilify women who make this choice, right? And so Northam went on a radio show, and basically he was discussing what would happen if a child was born after a failed attempt at an abortion. Because there are children that are born at like 25 weeks, 26 weeks, like they're born premature. And maybe in some cases, if a fetus is born premature after an attempt at an abortion or whatever, he said something that the infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. Ralph Northam is a doctor. So what he was talking about in this instance is probably cases where the baby has a low chance of survival, right? He's not talking about murdering actual babies. He's talking about, what do you do when you have decided to end a pregnancy because you know that it is difficult for the baby to survive on its own, and most likely that the baby will pass away. That's probably what he was talking about. He wasn't talking about literally murdering babies. And so Ben Sasse, basically, the senator, Ben Sasse, like, lost his fucking shit at Northam's words and basically stirred up a nationwide debate around this idea that late-term abortions are existing and people are aborting babies on, you know, in the ninth month of their pregnancy. Fucking insane. He's literally – Ben Sasse was equating this with infanticide. And I come from a country where infanticide is, like, a real thing, and it still happens. And this is not infanticide. Allowing women to have the choice to end or continue their pregnancy is not infanticide. And it's disgusting to accuse women of that.
Yeah. Here's my biggest issue with this. And first of all, abortions in the third trimester are exceedingly rare. It is very, very rare. If you've carried to the third trimester, you want the fetus to be viable. This isn't something that people just throw around lightly because they all of a sudden don't want to have a child. That's not how any of this works. And to suggest that it is really is an attack on all people who can get pregnant, because it's suggesting that we are unable to somehow make these critical medical decisions for ourselves in any sort of timely manner, or, you know, that we're just irresponsible, which is just so fucking frustrating to start with.
I just want to quickly correct myself. Kathy Tran introduced the bill. She was not the anti-choice person criticizing it. She introduced the bill, and then she was questioned on it. And because she was questioned on it, she slipped up and said abortion would be allowed until the point of birth. But that's not what she meant to say. So I do apologize for that. She is a Democrat. She introduced this bill. That's my bad. Keep going, Devin.
Got it. When people have this conversation with me, I always try to put it in context like this. So I was pregnant, and I had preeclampsia, which is dangerously high blood pressure. It's very dangerous for the mother and can lead to death. So I was induced, which means they medically started my labor process at 38 weeks, which is in the third trimester, but it technically not full term, because full term is 40 weeks. Basically, the argument people are making is that that is technically an abortion, because it was a medically induced birth. And again, if that sounds bananas, because it is. There's no, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, again, by the time you get there, you know, if I had had preeclampsia symptoms at, you know, 36 weeks, which is on the cusp of like a problem delivery, you know, I probably would have waited as long as possible to let my kid cook a little longer. I mean, women put themselves on the line all the time. And to say that we are incapable of putting ourselves on the line, we are incapable of making these decisions, is not just regressive, but infantilizing. These sort of arguments are treating women like they don't understand what's going on. And they're treating women like they are somehow unable to, I guess I get really emotional, which is why this is such an ideological debate when it really doesn't need to be, because I get really emotional about this, because to say that you can abort a fetus up until birth doesn't make any sense. If the fetus is able to be born, then it will be born. I just don't understand.
Yeah, to add some statistics into this, 92% of all abortions in the United States happen in the first trimester, according to Planned Parenthood. Only 1.4% of abortions happen at 21 weeks or after. And the third trimester begins at 28 weeks. And if you are beginning your third trimester at 28 weeks, or you're at 21 weeks, if you're at 21 weeks, you most likely know you are pregnant. Most likely, right? You most likely know you're pregnant. You most likely want or are planning to give up the baby for adoption. Like, you have a plan at 21 weeks. This is why only 1.4% of abortions happen after 21 weeks, or at 21 weeks and after, because that decision is deeply, deeply personal. And I'm assuming, if I looked at the data, it probably boils down to women having to decide that because of the health of the baby or the health of the mother, right? And so that's why it's so important, not just to... Yeah, it's so important not just to destigmatize abortion before this, but to destigmatize all female decisions, all decisions that women or people giving birth make, right? When people are entering a pregnancy, they make decisions every goddamn day. They make decisions about their prenatal care. They make decisions about, you know, the preschool that they eventually want to send their kids to. They make decisions about everything. And healthcare is the most important thing they probably make decisions about, because either they know they're not ready for a baby, or they enthusiastically are, and they are really making sure that they are on top of their shit. And that's why only 1.4% of abortions happen at 21 weeks or after, because by that point, women, because we are fully grown fucking adults, know what we are doing, right? And at the very least, we are seeking out doctors to tell us to do the correct thing. So what was really frustrating is, like, people like Nikki Haley was tweeting out after she saw this this video of Kathy Tran accidentally making a slip up in defending a really, really good bill. She tweeted, Nikki Haley tweeted, "What is happening in our country? This literally makes me sick to my stomach. Hashtag adoption is always an option." Except if you're a Republican and you don't like it when gay parents adopt, or you don't like it when interracial couples adopt, right? So what's really frustrating about this is that Republicans not only take agency away from women and people who are entering a pregnancy or are pregnant, they also explicitly try to say that they are supporting policies they don't actually support. They don't support government funding for really good social work. And, you know, they don't support Planned Parenthood when it comes to family planning. They don't support contraceptive care for every woman, right? So what's really frustrating is that not only on this one level is late-term abortion a bullshit term, also on the high level, the debate around abortion by most comes from the fact that most Republicans or most conservatives refuse to accept the fact that they can have one of two things. They can have no abortions in this country except for the medical need of the woman or the fetus. And if they want that, then they have to make sure that they are providing contraceptive care. They have to make sure they're providing contraceptive care, extensive family planning, and making sure that women have all the resources they need to make sure they are ready when they get pregnant. They are ready to have the baby, and they will have the baby. And also better care for when it comes to the adoption process, and less discrimination in adoption, better foster care. There's so many things that Republicans don't support if they really wanted to eliminate abortion.
Yeah, I mean, there was just a story about an adoption agency who won't adopt to Jews or same-sex couples. I mean, the whole thing is so fucking ridiculous. And it's so clear that it's, you know, we say it all the time, but it's a pro-birth platform, not a pro-life. Mm-hmm. It's not even, it's anti-choice and it's pro-birth. And, you know, again, I will never get over this, but it took them months. It took the Republican-controlled legislature months to fund CHIP, which is Children's Health Insurance Program. The C stands for children. They couldn't even fund that, which is a non-controversial piece of legislation. And And yet they're saying, no, you have to have that baby. That is fucking ridiculous. I would also just like to add one more thing about, you know, second and third trimester. And again, this is all coming from my own experience only. You know, I can't speak to other people who have been pregnant, but I started to show, like, I started to look pregnant around like 19, 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I was terrified. I was absolutely fucking terrified. But there was no way, unless there was a serious problem, that I was going to be able to abort the fetus at that point. Mm-hmm. And I'm not everyone. But like, I think we forget that we do forget. We forget that the people involved here are real fucking people. Like who have emotions and thoughts and opinions and just want access to fucking basic healthcare. And we talk so much as a party and, you know, with the 2020 primaries coming up, we talk so much about free healthcare for all, but then completely ignore the fact that that includes abortion care. And until we start getting that fucking right, I, you know, we cannot have a healthcare debate without talking about abortion care and contraception care and what our priorities really are.
I totally agree. And I feel like that's what's so difficult about the abortion quote unquote debate is that Republicans are trying to decide whether or not women have the fucking right to exist and make choices for themselves. And Democrats are so busy. We are so busy having to defend the fact that, yeah, you know what? Women do fucking exist. You know, we're real world people. We are adults and we make decisions and we're allowed to make decisions about our bodies that we don't get to get into the weeds of exactly how do we make sure that abortions are legal, safe, and they are accessible to everyone. And contraceptive care is legal, safe, and accessible to everyone. Like, it's so hard to have the real policy discussions we should be having about women's healthcare and maternal mortality. Because, you know, we talk about how the Republican Party, again, you mentioned it's a pro-birth party. Mm-hmm. They're not really a party that talks a lot about maternal mortality. They're not really a party that really goes deep into healthcare policy and how to actually understand what's going on in our hospitals and our healthcare facilities and how do we make sure that we are giving the best care possible as the, you know, the best country in the world, quote unquote, right? So I feel like so much gets thrown to the wayside in real discussion about policy and real discussion about making people's lives better when it comes to healthcare, especially women's healthcare, because for so long we've been trying to defend the fact that we have a right to fucking exist and make choices.
Well, yeah, and the Trump administration already gave away that game when they are, you know, they are working really hard on trans erasure. And mm-hmm. they're working really hard on LGBTQ erasure. And, you know, they're working really hard on racial erasure as well. I mean, with this white supremacist front and this idea that only, you know, straight white men are allowed to exist in public without being harassed or in fear of their safety. And so it makes perfect sense that they're trying to erase women as well. And this goes back to that article about the government shutdown, where that woman was quoted as saying, "He's not hurting the right people. He's hurting me, not the right people, not them." And when you other people, even if it's, you know, let's say you hate trans people and you other them and you erase them, when that happens, what do you think happens next? That's the end of it? No, they're going to keep going and they're eventually going to get to you. And that's part of what is going on here, is that if they manage to erase this, if they manage to make late-term abortions so outrageous that we have to ban all abortions, that's just one more form of erasure. Mm-hmm. And it's going to climb up the chain to everyone if we don't stop it now.
Yeah. Also, this, you know, the controversy, like, this means, like, this bill probably won't pass, which sucks. But there also is a risk that, like, eventually some Republican state will, because it's not a risk, it's already happening. So there is a case, and so, like, some Republican state will pass a bill that restricts abortion. It's going to get all the way up to the Supreme Court because, again, abortion is fucking legal under Roe v. Wade, and fucking Justice Brett Kavanaugh, you know, fucking doucheface is going to be the guy who ends abortion for everyone. Elections have motherfucking consequences. And so does...
Motherfucking consequences.
And so does, like, your internalized misogyny. It has consequences, too.
Yeah.
Like, this is the consequence, right? Like, it's so frustrating. Because the thing is, if we get to a point where we're talking about how... Because we were talking about this with Jussie Smollett, right? Like, if we get to a point where we're talking about how, oh, this abortion is not okay because of X, Y, and Z, and we're making prescriptive decisions for women and their doctors or people and their doctors, then... Eventually, we'll get to a point where we say, oh, I mean, just because she is 16 and was raped or whatever, you know, it's hard to justify an abortion in that case, right? Like, I hate making a slippery slope argument, but the thing is, it's really, really true. If you give somebody an inch on your existence and your ability to make choices for yourself, they will continue to chip away at that, because the other side doesn't just dislike abortion or isn't just anti-choice or isn't just quote pro-birth. They also have an intrinsic hatred of women and our ability to make choices. Right. It bothers them, right? We cannot give an inch on this. And I feel like that's what's so scary about having 5 Supreme Court justices that will overturn Roe v. Wade if they get the chance.
Which actually leads us in to our next section quite nicely, which is 2020, aka Kill Me Now. Because now there are 6,000 people running, and it's February 1st, 2019, and I'm already exhausted.
Yep.
But today, this morning, Cory Booker announced that he is going to be running for president. And I honestly, it annoyed me, which I know that is not the correct response. I happen to like Cory Booker quite a bit, and I think that he has that presidential quality, but I'm just so sick and tired of men. That's it. That's the whole sentence. I'm sick and tired of men, and I don't want them to run for president anymore. And, you know.
Yeah, somebody, obviously it was a dude. I was joking, and I mean, I was also being serious, but I was also joking, and I was just like, yeah, he was asking me about 2020. And I was like, yeah, I'm rooting for anyone who's a woman. And like, that's, I'm voting for a woman. I vote with my vagina. And I was obviously joking, because I said, I vote with my vagina. And he was like, so you really think you're going to choose a less competent woman over a man, you know? And I'm just like, dude, what the hell? No, that's not what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Just in case people don't know, you don't know like what this show is about. When Devin says, or when I say, I'm going to vote for a woman and I vote with my vagina, obviously, in this ideal world, if a man is more competent than a woman or is a better fit for president or a better candidate or whatever, obviously, we're going to vote for the man. It's not as if, like, in the future, Nikki Haley is running for president against Mike Pence, and those are my only two choices. Nikki Haley is running for president against Bernie Sanders, and those are my only two choices, and I have to choose between Bernie Sanders and Nikki Haley. I'm not going to say, yeah, I'm going to vote for Nikki Haley because she's a woman. No one says that. No one says that.
No.
I'm just saying we've had 242 years of male rule when it comes to the presidency. We could just try for a few months just giving women more of a platform and actually listening to how they would lead the country and decide, oh, it actually is okay to give women a chance. Like, it's okay to do that, right? And again,
right.
I like Cory Booker. I've met Cory Booker. I've met Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Cory Booker, like, very briefly. They're all three pretty awesome people. I've seen Kamala Harris speak live. Also an awesome person. I've watched Julian Castro talk about like what he wants to do. Like, also awesome person. Pete Buttigieg seems cool. Awesome. But like, in the
10 out of 10 would hang out with.
Yeah. In the end, it's going to be about two things for me, because I'm an intelligent person, but also a woman. I'm going to want someone who supports the policy preferences that I support, because it's a primary and that's how I vote. And two, I'm going to more likely want to vote for a woman. Right? That's just how it is.
Right.
That doesn't mean I'm the real sexist here. That's not how fucking sexism works. That's not how it works. Okay?
I love that argument. I'm like, you don't know how any of this works. You don't know what that word means.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And I mean, the best thing about Cory Booker announcing is, besides the fact that he's a great senator, it's also that like he announced on, you know, the first day of Black History Month. You know, Kamala Harris announced on Martin Luther King Day. So I think it's awesome that Cory Booker has announced. But I think the best thing about it is if you are on Twitter right now, if you're extremely online like I am, you are watching like senators like Kirsten Gillibrand being like, I'm rooting for you, Cory, but, you know, not too hard. And like all of these people who are working on different campaigns who used to work for either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or whatever, there's like a different level of camaraderie that I don't think I have ever seen in a primary before. At least I know it's early days. But I don't think we saw this in, you know, 2015 or in 2008, right? And I feel like that is just proof. The proof is like in the pudding, in the fact that this primary is going to be different, that we are really going to take seriously what we want as Democrats, what our Democratic values are. And we're going to choose not on stupid sexism or stupid racism or whatever, or classism or ageism. We're really going to be focusing on what our priorities are. And then when push comes to shove, after that fucking convention, we will line up and be like, yeah, you know what? Donald Trump is a bad guy. I think I should just vote for the Democrat.
You know what I really hate about the competency argument too, when people say, oh, you'd rather vote for a woman than a competent man, mm-hmm. is that implicit in that statement mm-hmm. is that women are incompetent. Like, it's yeah. subtle, right? Like,
yeah.
it's subtle because the argument is never, oh, you would vote for a man over a competent woman. Said no one ever, because that logic in our misogynistic culture doesn't make sense. The yeah. the idea, the base assumption is that women are incompetent, and so they have to go above and beyond to prove that they have a you know, a base level proficiency of competent, where men don't have to do that at all. And I think you really start to see this. Like, there is a lot of non-nuanced bullshit. I understand. Since Twitter, nuance is dead. I know.
Yeah.
But, there, you know, I really, really side-eye anything that smells like, A, a Dems in disarray narrative, or B, context-free analysis. And that is really already starting to happen. And it's particularly happening to Kamala Harris and in the hours since Cory Booker has announced. It almost feels like a lot of those these like hit pieces were written before he even announced.
I mean, that
right?
does
just
happen.
Had him, like, ready yeah. to go.
That does happen. I mean, I
know.
I think it is fair. It's like, it's what's really frustrating is like you hit it on the head is like, yeah, nuance is fucking dead, because it's fair to be like, yeah, Kamala Harris has a troubled history when it comes to her prosecutorial past, but also I am a fair person and I'm not going to hold her criminal justice record to a higher standard than every other Democrat in the primary, right? If I say I'm right. questioning Kamala Harris's criminal justice record, I better be questioning Cory Booker's record, Bernie Sanders' record, Kirsten Gillibrand's record, Elizabeth Warren's record, Julian Castro's record. If I say, oh, I can't vote for Cory Booker because he used to be pro-charter school, I better be looking up the education records of every other fucking candidate. And I feel like what's really frustrating about right. 2020 already, even though there is this camaraderie, even though we do know there is a bigger threat than the minute differences in policy between Democratic candidates, which is Donald Trump, there is this racialized and there is this racist and sexist way of talking about people of color candidates and women candidates that we are seeing. And we're seeing more of it because the best thing right. about 2020 so far is that there is only one straight white dude running. Technically, so far,
right.
it's John Delaney. Everybody right. else is either there's Pete Buttigieg, who's a gay white dude. There is Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand, who are white women. There's Kamala Harris, who's a black person. There's Cory Booker. There's Julian Castro. Everyone else is like diverse. It is a really diverse field. And right. so unlike 2015 and 2016, it is going to be really hard for the media to like self-check themselves because they haven't had to do that for so long. It's usually only been two white dudes running or maybe one black person, right?
No, it's so hard. It's so, so hard here because, you know, the things that are being posted about Kamala Harris, it's because it's not just people questioning her prosecutorial record. Mm-hmm. It's also people questioning her relationship with Willie Brown.
Yeah.
And this sort of like sinister implication that she, quote, slept her way to the top. And
so
again,
disgusting.
That logic, so gross. That logic only works on women, right? It's yeah. never the other way around. It's never, and to do so completely delegitimizes her from the gate, not even talking about her policy record. Oh, she slept her way to the top. Who cares? She hasn't she hasn't performed that base level competency because of this, yeah, this reason, right? Because she was in a relationship with Willie Brown. And the other thing that annoys me, because there's a lot these days, is that so Washington Post has put out a ranking of who they think will win against Trump if elected to be the Democratic candidate. And currently the top of the list is Kamala Harris, who I stand pretty hard. And actually, I do want to do a whole show about Kamala Harris's prosecutorial record, because I think it's worth going over and diving into. But I do. I think that she is – that bitch did not come to play.
Nope.
Like, she is the most ready, the most, like, competent, just, like, she is ready. And yeah, and I don't know. I think she's great. But they have at number three Sherrod Brown, who's a Democrat from Ohio.
Yeah.
Sherrod Brown, who has not announced a candidacy, although he's doing that like coy will they won't they sitcom thing where he keeps bringing it up but like won't give an answer. But he's a straight white dude and sort of like the white bread of populists. Like, you know, he's gone on this whole like dignity of work campaign, which is definitely because he wants to run for president. But it's so I don't know. I don't want to say boring because it's important, but it's so bland, you know. But he's already in the number three spot on this ranking list from Washington Post, which is, first of all, a very solid news outlet. Second of all, quite liberal. And third of all, like, thoroughly researched. I just, what is wrong? Why? Why?
So basically I agree with you and I agree with everyone on Twitter and all my friends who are like, yeah, Sherrod Brown is fucking great because he is fucking great. He's really pro-labor.
He's fucking
great. I have some issues with him on trade, but like I don't have to go into that, right? Like he's a great Democrat. He's a solid Democrat. Also, he is like a great senator from Ohio. And I am not one of those people who says, oh, but if he runs and wins, then we will lose the Senate seat in Ohio. And I'm like, I don't care about that. Like, yeah, we will lose Senate seat in Ohio. We'll have to win it back eventually, right? If he's the best candidate, he's the best candidate. It's more that, and this is not his fault. This is not other women candidates' fault. This is sort of the media's fault. He, like, he's sort of like a rumpled guy, okay? Like, he, like, sort of like Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
He's not really, like, clean cut. And again, that's not against him, because I really don't really give a fuck what a president looks like right now. Like, at this point, like, it doesn't really matter to me, because I shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be criticizing what women wear, and we also definitely shouldn't be, like, criticizing what men wear. But what's interesting is that, like, he's not getting short shrift for that because he's a dude. Like, when
right.
Beto was running for Senate,
right.
that dude was sweating through his pits. No one wrote a whole article about, like, why is Beto O'Rourke sweating through his pits? Shouldn't he buy a more expensive shirt and buy some better deodorant? But we will see a 12,000-word piece on, you know, Hillary Clinton's sartorial choices. But specifically how, like, they show that she is too rich for our blood.
Exactly. Or you know, the length of Kamala Harris's skirt. Like, I could just feel that one coming.
That is coming. Or how Kirsten Gillibrand looked when she was pregnant, right? Like Kirsten Gillibrand was literally harassed by another senator when she was pregnant, like, multiple times. She's told this story about, like, how people really – senators really make comments about her being a little bit chubby while she was pregnant. And I was livid when she told, like, when she told people this. I was like, holy hell. But – you know, Sherrod Brown gets to go on CNN in a hoodie because that is what he did. Again, this is nothing against Sherrod Brown's policies. Not at all.
Right.
This is just right. I'm criticizing the media and basically our gaze, like, as the American people on what we think is electable. And I think Sherrod Brown, to be
exactly.
completely fair,
that's
is electable.
That's the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah. It's totally electable. It's just that we are saying he's electable while not even talking about the fact that, but we wouldn't allow a woman to be like this, you know?
To do this, right? Like, again, there was again on the Beto thing, there was a wonderful piece, and I think I talked about it on here before, but it basically nailed why Beto irritates me so much, is that he lost a Senate race and then he's gone on this like this like personal journey of self-awareness and self-growth. I mean, he basically went on a fucking like yoga retreat, but like campaigning across Texas, and everyone's like, yeah, that dude should be president. If a woman lost a Senate race and then went on a journey of self-reflection, like, they'd make a movie starring Julia Roberts about her, and that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a clear double standard here. And, I mean, which is, like, water wet, sky blue, duh. But it's just like, it's so obvious when Washington Post has Sherrod Brown at number 3 to beat Trump, when that motherfucker hasn't even announced his candidacy yet. Like, what is wrong with people?
I know. And so, like, that's my issue with Beto as well. It's not that, like, I don't think he is a good person or would make a good president or whatever. It's more that people get angry at me when I point out the double standard. And they're like, oh, are you saying Beto is not competent? Is Sherrod Brown not a good guy? No, that's not what I'm fucking saying. I'm saying, hey, why don't we just question our internalized misogyny and what's going on in the media when it comes to the reporting on this stuff? Are we allowed to do that without being called the Antichrist? Like, is it okay? Like, I'm not like anti-labor or anti-Democrat for saying it's weird that Sherrod Brown gets a pass on wearing a hoodie on live television to do an interview about Howard Schultz and you know, running for president or whatever he was interviewing about, yeah, and labor, while, you know, Kamala Harris gets articles written up about her and it was an op-ed from Willie Brown. Like, that was published. An editor was like, yeah, let's listen to Willie Brown talk about how he dated Kamala Harris. That's not sexist at all. You know, we're not gonna ask Kimberly Guilfi, I don't know what her name is. We're not gonna ask her to write an op-ed about how she dated Gavin Newsom, but, you know, we will do that for Willie Brown and Kamala Harris. Like, what the fuck, right? I'm allowed to point out the double standard, like, without saying that one person is worse than the other. I'm not picking sides here. I'm just saying there's a double standard. We should address that because we're going into a long fucking primary. And then those double standards are going to have life or death consequences eventually.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. And it never, ever works the other way. It's not ever like, oh, this woman, you know, it's never let's give women the benefit of the doubt. It's never like maybe Sherrod Brown should not run because there are already competent fucking women running. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, you know, people have to put their hopes and dreams on hold or anything, but like, come on, yeah, have a little bit of strategy here. And it just boggles my mind because that's exactly what they would say to anyone. That's what they're saying to women. They're like, oh, you should move out of the way and let the big boys play. Is
that's
basically
literally
what they're
historically
saying.
Accurate.
But no one,
yeah,
thinks to say that to fucking, and that's not what they're saying to Beto.
Exactly. So abolitionists throughout the 19th century, a lot of them were fucking women. A lot of reformers were women. And then eventually white men were like, wait a second. No, you can't lead. You know, let the men do that. And so I was making this point to someone,
right,
who was criticizing me and trying to call me the real sexist. And I was like, listen, for 242 years, the presidency has been affirmative action for dudes, okay? There was one black dude, and then the other 44 have been white dudes. I just think it is okay if you believe in affirmative action, if you believe that we should have a system where it's not just equal opportunity, but real equal opportunity of outcome, where, you know, women are not just given the chance to run, but are actually allowed to contend. Are not just allowed, but like treated like they are contenders, then you should be rooting for only women. And I don't give a fuck if you're listening to this and you're like, huh, Varsha is the real sexist. I don't care what you say. That is just the truth. The presidency has been affirmative action for white men for too fucking long. And one black person, right, Barack Obama, got through. That's great. But for too fucking long, it has been affirmative action for white women, for white men. And I'm sick of it. I can't do this anymore. And then somebody said to me, what did somebody say? They were just like, yeah, but, you know, and they made this point. They're like, yeah, but shouldn't we just focus on winning 2020, not like focusing on like whether or not electing a woman is the most important thing? And I'm like, that's a false choice. What the fuck are you saying? Because, yeah, implicit in that sentence that you just told me that we should focus on winning 2020, not just electing a woman, you're saying that if a woman is the nominee, there is a chance, there's a higher chance that she will lose to Trump than a man. That is the real sexism, right, my friend. That is the real sexism.
That's the problem. These women are being picked apart. And you're right. We need to treat these women like contenders. Not, yeah, like, oh, they're just here, you know, for, you know, like, because we're so diverse. Like, no. These are the people that we are going to elect. And again, I think asking if a woman could win in 2020 is the wrong fucking question.
Yeah.
The right question is, who represents us and who is going to take us into a better way of governance? And the answer, I'm sorry, is not Sherrod Brown. It's just not. It's certainly not Trump. It's not John Delaney. It is not Howard Schultz, who I don't even want to fucking talk about
because fuck that guy.
I'm annoyed. Fuck that guy. It's not St. Bernard of Sanders.
It's not Joe Biden. Like, it's not, and like, yeah. And it's not Beto.
Joe Biden. No. God, Joe Biden is like the one person. I know this sounds nuts, but Joe Biden is the one person that I would have a hard time casting my ballot for. I would do it if I had to, but I would make a big stink about it after I did it because fuck that guy.
Exactly. I mean, I feel like that's what's so difficult, yeah, for people to understand is like me saying that I like Sherrod Brown's policies, I like Cory Booker's policies, I like all of these male candidates that have announced well enough, but I am voting for a woman or a woman of color first, or I am going to focus my energy on supporting them first. That doesn't mean that when push comes to shove and on like the last day before my primary vote, if I like look at my fucking pros cons list and I realize, oh, I guess it really is Julian Castro. That's the person I'm casting a ballot for. I will fucking do that. Because again, as we talked about with the abortion issue, women, we have brains. We can make choices that are logical. But ultimately, my position on the fact that we should elect a woman in 2020 comes from the fact that the presidency has been affirmative action for white dudes for too fucking long, okay? It's too long.
Yeah, and it's not fucking working. That's the other thing. If, like, shit were going well, this would be a different conversation. But shit has gone directly to hell. Obviously, what we're doing is not working, and we need to pull it the fuck together.
Yeah. And basically what's really frustrating is this idea that basically it's immediately accepted that a candidate like Beto or Sherrod or maybe even Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders or whatever like represents the people, right? Immediately it's accepted that they have like cornered the market on a certain issue. Like Joe Biden can really talk to Midwestern voters. Sherrod Brown really knows labor.
Oh my
Beto
God, thank
O'Rourke
you.
Is like the Southern Kennedy, right? Like it's immediately accepted that, as I said before, that they're contenders and they've already staked out their claim. But it
that
is never
populist.
True of that
right.
for women. Like there are so few pieces, and the pieces that are written about this are really good, but there are so few journalists and pieces out there about how Elizabeth Warren is the anti-corruption and anti-rampant deregulated bank candidate. Like she is the candidate for that. She is the candidate that has spent her whole career tackling deregulation and banking and how it has fucked over people, right? She basically created a whole fucking agency to do that, right? But very few
she
articles
did.
Talk
she
about
created
that.
A whole fucking agency so that yes, all of these three men who, by the way, none of which have actually announced a candidacy but we're still talking about them. They each have this idea that, you know, the mythology around them is that they can talk to the people, that they are great uniters of people. And what they really mean is that they are uniters of white men, and that white men are the most important demographic, and that we need to make sure that we reach out to those white men who are so oppressed. But they're mythologized as these like, yeah, like these people who can bring people together. I wonder why people think that. Go fuck yourself. Like, come on. Yeah. They're contenders already and they haven't even announced. And the other thing, and I just, last point on this that really tickles me pink, I'm being sarcastic, is that when Nancy Pelosi was up for the speakership, the main rallying cry of her detractors was, we need fresh blood, fresh faces. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi's too old. She's too establishment. She's too bad. I don't know. And then when it comes to the primary, we're throwing out names that have already been thrown out before. Joe Biden was the vice president for 8 years. He hasn't been on a ticket individually in over 10. I mean, I don't know. You know, Beto lost a Senate race. I cannot get over how people are like, well, you lost, so we definitely want to put you in the, like, what is wrong with you? Yeah, we're throwing out these names that have gotten thrown out before.
Yeah. I was also going to make one last point. So now that we have many people of color who are running for office, running for president, we have Julian Castro, we have Kamala Harris, we have Cory Booker. One thing that we can do as people who are probably not part of that minority group. You know, if I am not a Black woman, I'm not a Black person, so I shouldn't be saying, ever trying to speak for their community, and specifically saying that, like, oh, I know exactly what Cory Booker did, and he is not good for the, you know, for Black people. Or Kamala Harris, I know her prosecutorial record, she is not good for Black people. Or Julian Castro is not good for Hispanic people. First of all, that's stupid. Right. Second of all, if you really want to understand whether or not a candidate is going to support minority communities, talk to their constituents. You know, go to California, right. Talk to people in San Francisco where she was a DA, talk to people who lived through her being the AG about Kamala Harris. If you're talking about Cory Booker and you want to understand what was his relationship like with criminal justice and issues that affect the Black community, talk to people who lived through his mayorship in Newark. Talk to people in New Jersey. Don't try to speak for them yourselves. I feel like that's the one major thing. It's like if somebody like comes up and tells me like, yeah, I don't think I can vote for, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand because she pushed out Al Franken. Go talk to a fucking sexual harassment survivor before you try to speak. Right. So that's basically that was my last point is like, don't speak for other people. Speak for yourself and learn.
Yeah. And to like just like wrap that up really nicely. Do your fucking research. Mm-hmm. Like do some homework. You know, democracy is a contact sport, and you sitting there spewing out your feelings is irritating as shit.
Okay, Devin, what are some action items people can do after listening to the show?
Okay, so there's just one. So the House has announced H.R. 1. So there's always an H.R. 1, which is the first thing, and it kind of signals what the majority's priorities are going to be for that session of Congress. And so Nancy Pelosi has put out H.R. 1, which is anti-corruption. It would make voting day a federal holiday. It would, try to reduce gerrymandering and like political motivations for gerrymandering. It would, force candidates to release their tax returns. It's like a whole omnibus of like, go fuck yourself, Trump, basically. Yeah. And it is going to pass in the House, but it McConnell called it a power grab because apparently getting people to vote is a power grab. So it's likely unlikely to go anywhere in the Senate, but you can still call your senators, call your representatives and tell them that you support H.R. 1 mm-hmm. and tell them that you want to see it through and call your senators specifically if you have a Republican senator, but really anyone. Yeah. I haven't talked to Kamala Harris's office in a while, so I'm going to call her up. Tell them that they need to pass it.
Yeah. It's a great bill because it's not just about like making sure people have the right to vote. It also is reforming campaign finance. It's strengthening government's ethics laws to like make sure that like Congress people can't be fucking around when they're elected and expands voting rights, which is the most important thing. And I think what's great about we didn't even talk about this, and I really want to throw in just a quick hellion. My hellion personally is Stacey Abrams. Do you know why? Because Stacey Abrams is giving the response to the State of the fucking Union. And Chuck Schumer said something. He's made the smartest decision Chuck Schumer has made in his whole goddamn life. Because he said, I chose Stacey Abrams because she is at the heart of fighting for voting rights. And that is the root of every issue. And that is true. And that's what I really like. If I had a mantra or like a thing to focus on for 2020, is like, who is going to be so focused in on voting rights? Because if they know what's going on with voting rights and what's going on with voter suppression and gerrymandering and basically our whole election system, then I know they have democratic values at heart, that they understand what people of color and elderly people and young people are going through when it's hard for them to vote. And so Stacey Abrams is giving the fucking response to the State of the Union, and I hope she does it at like the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in front of this giant live audience.
Oh my God.
And treats it like a rallying cry, not just for voting rights, but as exactly what Devin said earlier, is like the values that we as Democrats share and that the Trump administration is trampling on, right? And yeah, so call your senators in support of H.R. 1 and as well as your House members, but also you better be fucking watching the response to the State of the Union because Stacey fucking Abrams is a boss-ass bitch and I'm so excited.
Oh my God, Stacey, you know what? I cannot believe we forgot to talk about this.
There's a fresh fucking face for you, white dudes. That's a fresh face.
Yeah, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, no one's like, let's get Stacey Abrams to run for president. Like, what the fuck is wrong? You know what? I don't want to talk about it because it'll make me angry. But Stacey Abrams, when she ran for governor of Georgia, she didn't just run a campaign. She ran a movement.
Mm-hmm.
She changed things. She changed things intrinsically, and she made her whole life about making it easier for people to vote.
Yeah.
She is the perfect person. You're exactly right. This is the smartest thing Chuck Schumer has ever done in his whole damn life, because she is where the Democratic Party is heading. She is the one. She is the Democratic Party. And honestly, I've had the pleasure to speak to her twice, and that woman is going to change the fucking world. And I have the honor and privilege to live in the time that she will do it.
Yeah.
So on that actually pretty uplifting note for a pretty heavy episode, I think that is it for Varsha and I. Thank you, Hellion, so much for listening. And, you know, we will be back here next week. So in the meantime, raise some hell and remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere. Thank you.